Hey guys, welcome to another episode of the Left Wing Propaganda Machine. It is the creator, host, and producer of the Left Wing Propaganda Machine, Mohammed Hassan, here with another episode. I would just like to say before we get into this episode, thank you guys so much for the support that I've been receiving recently. I hit over 600 subscribers on YouTube, still growing, and I hit over a couple hundred plays on streaming services. That is insane. I would like to thank all of the support that has come my way. You guys have been so motivating. I know I've been gone for like 3 weeks now, but that's because I had a bunch of schoolwork to do, a bunch of personal problems that I've had to deal with, and a bunch of, you know, university decisions and all this kind of stuff that I've been just trying to balance. Like, life is really crazy right now, and I thank you guys all for the patience that you guys have had. Thank you to all the messages, the DMs, the conversations I've had have been amazing. I'm actually going to have a episode talking about Palestine and Israel with somebody who approached me through Twitter and through DMs. I had an interview with somebody who was, you know, talking about left-wing politics, and it's been really amazing to have all of these discussions, to have all of these debates with people, and just talk and reach out, because, you know, it's just beautiful to hear all of you guys' support, all of you guys' criticisms too. I've been taking it, and I've really been trying to take this more seriously. It's also motivated me to try and look beyond what I can do, beyond politics, beyond my podcast, see if looking into video essays would be something that I'm doing. But of course, being in year 12 and doing A-levels at the same time, it is kind of difficult to all balance, so I would just say please have some patience. But thank you guys all for the support. It has been incredible. You guys are so cool. Now, it's time to stop jerking you guys off for giving me likes and views. Let's get into today's episode, a critique into cancel culture, how to critique, why we should be critiquing, where can we actually utilize critique, and why it's different from cancel culture, and is there any problems with cancel culture that we need to talk about? You see, because if there's something that I've realized within the many political discussions and debates and any kind of conversations that I've had, is that there is a total lack of ability currently to critique and evaluate political arguments from both sides of the table, okay? And, you know, I said that, like, recently. This has kind of been within human nature. We find it very difficult to actually come to an ability to critique. Like, having critical thinking is a skill that a lot of us lack. You see, because whether it's transgender rights, Black Lives Matter, abortion, immigration, or the economy, there seems to be no space for nuanced discussion surrounding the issues at hand. You know, take a step even further back into the realms of pop culture, music, films, art, education, media, or everyday dispute, there seems to be a fundamental inability within our communities to critique one another without it evolving into disdain towards each other or even worse communication than before. I mean, how many times have you played sports or been in a group activity and not liked something that a teammate or a classmate was doing, and suddenly what you think, which is pointing out some misdirection, ends up becoming a total shit show of curse words and fuck yous and you're so mean to each other? And this is in real life. I mean, we haven't even begun to get into the absolute hellhole that is social media and places like YouTube comments, Twitter, Instagram, Discord, or Reddit, where normal discussion is limited to conversations about cat videos and Vine compilations that saved you from depression. That's an actual category, by the way, for boomers or old people who have no idea what I just said. I mean, even the latest Netflix documentary spurs TV debates and online blog posts that require trigger warnings. And almost everything I will talk about in this podcast, I find myself devolving into world of Twitter fives and rants. Well, because, you know, I'm also a 17-year-old and I can succumb to the temptation of calling someone a dipshit over Twitter. Also, I would just like to say that so many people have been like, oh my god, you're so introspective and politically aware for your age. Wow, you're so smart. I would just like to make two notes about this. First of all, thank you, of course. I really appreciate the comments. It's really nice to, you know, inject my ego with more appreciation from people. And two, while it is appreciated, do not try to make me to some hero or some leader that you can look up to, because I'm just a 17-year-old kid who's talking on the internet and trying to learn just as much as you are. And also, hero creation or projection is dangerous, and I'll talk more about why it's dangerous within left-wing politics specifically and why it's so dangerous in politics altogether, because I believe that we should all try to be leaders together as a collective and not depend on specific leaders. But if I go too much into that, then my thoughts are anarchy, and I haven't finished reading On Anarchism by Noam Chomsky and An Ethical Justification for Authentic Democracy by my philosophy teacher, which I want to do in a later episode. But what I'm saying is that just don't try and, you know, glorify me. But if we get back into the conversation that we're actually going to have, what I'm saying is that there seems to be a lack of fundamental ability to critique. And I don't mean cancel or show disdain towards someone else. I mean truly critique. See, what do I mean by critique? You see, a critique or critical analysis, a critique sounds really cute and like posh, but I'm going to stop saying it because it sounds weird as well. It's a detailed analysis and assessment of something, especially within a literary, philosophical, or political theory. That's the Google definition. You see, now that sounds a lot like a counter-argument or a disagreement. It's in fact not. You see, the most important part is a detailed analysis and assessment. You see, why is this different to a disagreement or a counter-argument? You see, a counter-argument aims to disprove or invalidate an argument or conclusion. The critique is an understanding of the argument at hand and an in-depth look into not only its conclusions that it makes, but how does it come to those conclusions? What data does it use to back up the claims that it makes? Is this data valid and or sufficient enough to stand up against any possible criticism? You see, critiques aim to come to conclusions that are nuanced and analytical and importantly challenge both sides or multiple sides of the discussion or debate, something I personally have learned is incredibly difficult to do. So when we talk about critiquing, when we talk about critical analysis, it's not just disagreeing with something. It's looking at an argument, it's looking at a set of principles, for example, or a set structure, and trying to see whether it logically follows something, whether we can poke holes at certain justifications, whether, okay, all the justifications make sense, but this conclusion just came out of nowhere. Where did you get this conclusion? Does that actually link with any of the data that you backed up? Oh, that data that you have, is that data sourced well? Is it peer-assessed well? Is it peer-reviewed well, sorry? Is it actually substantive? Is it in-depth? And has it been evaluated by other people that have validated the claims that are made by the data? You see, if we look at critiquing and critical analysis and critical thinking in general, it goes way beyond just a disagreement or a counter-argument. You see, disagreements and counter-arguments, as I said, tend to try and disprove the other claim by bringing in new evidence. What a critique does is not only try and bring in new evidence, but look at the evidence at hand. It says, okay, person X, say I'm person X, for example, and then there's person Y. Person X, me, brings out evidence A, B, and C to show that cats are better than dogs. And then you say, okay, you brought out evidence A, B, and C. And A, B, and C, the sources are valid, everything is right, but your conclusion that cats are better than dogs seems unfounded, because if you actually look at the data points, if we actually look at the statistics that you brought forward, it's very hard to actually come to that conclusion. And I would disagree with you, and I'd actually challenge you to show me how this conclusion has come about, because to me, there's no logical following on here. And then I would say, well, if you look at evidence X and you look at evidence Y and you put them together, you can then extrapolate from here about that cats are better than dogs. And you could say to me, well, actually no, you can't extrapolate from it, because that succumbs to a logical fallacy, or it succumbs to this, you know, illogical, you know, take on logic, or, you know, it has a false lemma within it that undermines the whole argument and the whole evidence. So critical thinking is a lot of the times looking at the evidence or the argument that someone's proposed and saying, hey, if you use your logic doesn't actually fit very well with the conclusion that you've made, or the conclusion that you've made doesn't really fit well with your logic. The conclusion that you make might be true, it might be correct, but I wouldn't really suggest using this evidence. You see, I've had a lot of discussions with left-wing people, for example, where they've said, they brought up this thing about you know, this person being racist or this person being homophobic, for example, and they brought up a joke that they made, for example, like on a comedic sketch, and I said, hey, listen, that person could be homophobic, and the way that they make those jokes sounds like they are, but if you want to substantiate your claim, you're gonna have to bring multiple pieces of evidence that show a consistent trend of homophobia or racism. And people might be thinking, oh wait, what, are you excusing this joke? I'm like, no, I'm not excusing this joke. What I'm saying to you is, I don't disagree with you, but if I'm going to critique you, I'm saying, hey, I might agree with your conclusion, but I can't really take it because the evidence that it has isn't really substantial. And that's the thing that we need to really be recognizing, is that, hey, when we critique things, we're not disagreeing with them. We're kind of saying that, yo, these things aren't invalid. I might even want it to be valid, but I can't really take it as a whole because the arguments that you make, the evidence that you provide, don't really show any kind of, evidence or any trend that actually follows this way. You know what I mean? So you might be asking me, okay, you know what the difference between a critique and the difference between a... Sorry if you can hear my microphone moving. I'm trying to get it so that I'm speaking directly into my microphone and so you can hear me well, because people have said that the sound is kind of bad in previous episodes. But how do we actually critique? So if we look at actually how to critique, and I am also learning this, by the way, but these are some kind of pointers that I've realized. Okay, the number one thing that has been incredibly helpful to me, okay, if I'm looking at political theory, or if I'm looking at an idea, I'm looking at a conclusion, what are the extrinsic elements and what are the intrinsic elements? So say, for example, I proposed that we fund more into schools, and then you said, oh, well, that's going to require more government intervention, that's going to require a layoff of jobs, that's going to rely a cutting to the army or to etc, etc. Now, does funding into schools really mean that I have to do all those other things? Is it an intrinsic element that I cut funding to the army, or I, you know, raise taxes, or I have more government intervention? Or are those all intrinsic elements that I can not have to do and still reach my goal? So a good part about this kind of extrinsic versus intrinsic kind of thinking, and let me just define extrinsic and intrinsic. Intrinsic means that it is bound to, like, part of that thing materializing includes this characteristic. Extrinsic means that this thing can materialize or this thing can occur without that thing happening. So say, for example, me going outside, okay, an intrinsic element of that is me walking outside, right? An extrinsic element of that is me wearing clothes to go outside. Like, yeah, usually I will wear clothes, but I don't have to. Like, I don't physically have to wear clothes to go outside, but I have to walk outside or move myself or transport myself outside of my home to a place outside to actually be outside. So an intrinsic part of that is movement or transportation. An extrinsic part of that is the clothing that I decide to wear. So if you look at the intrinsic elements and the extrinsic elements of an argument, if you look at the extrinsic or intrinsic elements of ideas and theory, you then get to realize that, hey, some of the points I'm making aren't really relevant because they don't actually deal with the proper context of the arguments and the actual points made within the argument. And that's another point that you have to make. What is the context of the argument that this is being written? I've learned this a lot in philosophy. So in philosophy, a lot of things that students make, a lot of mistakes students make, and I've been part of this as well, I'm not trying to act like I'm some savior, is that we just say arguments. Like, the teacher, my teacher will ask us, okay, what does Kant think about this? And you'll just say, oh, Kant says X, Y, and Z. And then he'll be like, okay, but what does that mean? Because I can tell you that Kant believes that if you have a rule, that it should be universal. But what does that actually mean? What's the context of this argument? Why does Kant think that something should be universal? Why does Kant believe that we should, have universal laws, for example? And then you kind of think and you go, okay then. So Kant believes that we should have universal laws because he believes in the two formulations, that there shouldn't be a contradiction in will and there shouldn't be a contradiction in nature. And if there's a contradiction in will, it means that, you know, you wouldn't want this thing happening to you, then, you know, why would we allow that thing to happen to anybody else? And if there's a contradiction in nature, as in the predicate of the subject actually contradicts with itself, then we can't have those things happening. So it doesn't really make any sense that we should do that. We should have this rule, for example, and then the universal law adds on top of that, that when we have universal laws, it means that we are fair to everybody and that we allow people to be treated as equals, which is kind of weird because Kant was a bit of a fucking racist. So it's weird that he wanted universal laws only for white people. It's not very universal, Mr. Kant. Not very universal. But again, you see, you have to look at the context of the arguments, the actual points being made. And that means that sometimes what you think is the first point is actually a response to a point before it. So, for example, in innatism and empiricism, Locke's point that Locke makes are actually responses to points that other people make. Like, the only reason he's making these arguments aren't as in, like, he's just saying this from himself. He's actually saying this as a response. And you have to recognize that it's a response because, through our critical thinking, okay, if this argument is a response to something, does it actually deal with the thing that is responding to, or does it just bring up new arguments that are not valid and are totally irrelevant to the points that were being made before it. And that's a massive thing that lots of people get bogged down in. Because when I have discussions with people, and a lot of conservatives will do this, because conservatives suck dick in the totally non-gay way, because being gay is fine, and I just see how that was kind of offensive. But you know what I mean, like, they're just terrible at arguments, right? Conservatives totally suck. So when I'm having an argument with them, I'll make a point, and then they'll bring in a point out of nowhere and be like, what about this? And I'm like, that's a terrible response, because you actually haven't dealt with the data and all the arguments that I've brought forward to you. And then they'll say, oh, but you're steamrolling the conversation, you just want us to focus on this thing. No, because I want you to focus on this one thing, because if you can't focus on this one bit of evidence that I have, if you can't disprove this, then I can't take anything else that you have seriously, because if you can't deal with this, and the rest of your stuff doesn't matter, because this is the issue at hand. Conservatives will always do this, especially with the Black Lives Matter protests. You'll bring up things like, oh, socioeconomic factors matter, and then you'll be like, oh, but what about this? And they'll be like, oh, well, if you adjust it for socioeconomic factors, if you check all these things and you get rid of all the variables, well, the statistics still are on our side. And then they'll bring up these random facts about cultures and all this stuff, and it just gets bogged down in these dumb responses that don't actually deal with the points being made. And then you have to ask yourself another thing, and how do we critique? Is an argument actually being made? Like, are they actually saying, okay, we have X, we have Y, we have Z, here is our conclusion? Or are just saying, hey, we have this, and we have that, and we have that, and we have this. They'll do this again. A lot of people will say, oh, I have an argument, but then won't actually make an argument, because an argument is a set of propositions that are logically linked together that lead to a conclusion. And I can't critique your argument if you don't have an argument. If you're not actually making any points and trying to come to a conclusion, and then what's the point that you're trying to make? See, this is the thing, again, with a lot of right-wing people will do is they'll be like, okay, there's a problem with the elite. And then I'll be like, okay, what do you want me to do with that information? What do you want me to do with it? You haven't said an argument. You've just said, oh, there's a problem there. Okay, what's your solution to it? Why is it a problem? These are the questions that we have to be asking ourselves when we're critiquing other people. Because if we don't, when we're critiquing literature, when we're critiquing philosophy, when we're critiquing ideas, when we're critiquing discussions and debates, we have to look at, hey, what is the actual arguments being made? What are the points that they are making? Okay? Sources. Okay? Asking for sources and information has to be normalized. Like, I realize that if you start asking people for evidence beyond anecdotal evidence that shouldn't be taken seriously because it's anecdotal, like, listen, there's a place and time for anecdotal evidence, but not in a debate about systemic issues. I'm about to burp, hold on. Okay, I don't know if you heard that burp. If you did, I might edit out, I might not, just keep the raw vibe going on. But what was I saying? Oh yeah, sources. Okay, asking for sources and information has to be normalized. There's so many times when you get bogged down in anecdotal evidence. Oh, well, I experienced this, and I experienced this, and white privilege doesn't exist because I got called a... I'm not going to say that word, because my white people might get offended. But you know what I mean? Like, we have to be sure that we don't get bogged down in anecdotal evidence when we're dealing on large-scale systematic issues. You know what I mean? In politics, we do that a lot. We deal with large-scale issues that incorporate hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people. So anecdotal evidence isn't necessary. When we're dealing with talks about capitalism and socialism and all these things, we have to look at data. We have to look at the actual statistics and the information that is being normalized. And you actually also have to look at these sources as well. Like, if someone brings out a statistic, don't just take that statistic at face value. Say, okay, where did you get that statistic from? What is the conclusion that's being made? Has this statistic been peer reviewed? And people have made fun of me for doing this. Like, oh, what, you want me to have a statistic and a source for every single point that I made so that it can be validated and backed up with evidence? Fuck yeah, I do. What do you mean? We have to normalize this kind of discussion, because this is the thing. This is why I hate debates in school. Because this kind of stuff isn't normalized. People just bring up random statistics, and then everyone's like, oh my god, no. How do we deal with this one statistic? Ask about that statistic. Prod at the statistic. Say, okay, does this statistic, can this statistic be taken validly? Because I can make up a statistic about anything, okay? I can say 100% of male students at my school take history, for example. And then you can say to me, well, yeah, the context of those statistics is kind of necessary because you go to an all-boys school. And in fact, yeah, they all do take history, but only up to grade year nine, and then after that they can actually decide what subjects they want to take. But and I could say no, but they do all take history, and they're like, yeah, but that doesn't really paint the full picture because it doesn't show that if you look at A level, for example, history is one of the less applied to subjects. At GCSE, more students take geography than history, and then you can prod at that statistic. So at face value, my statistic of 100% of male students at my school take history when they're at school is actually not as, substantial as it may seem, because if you look at the context of the statistic, if you look at where that statistic is actually drawing its evidence from, what parts it's taking into account, what parts it's not taking into account, then, you realize that, hey, this statistic shouldn't really be dealt with properly because it's kind of based on bullshit. So, also, time. Now, what I'm talking about right now is critiques take a lot of time to go through, and this is a thing that I feel like a lot of people have to get out of, taking the easy route of just accepting the data within you and not critiquing it at all. I am so happy that I have this fear of being brainwashed by any literature that's put in front of me, so I always check it. Like, okay, part of it has to do with my massive ego that I don't want to feel like anybody else is forcing me or coercing me into doing something, so I always go and search and I always go and Google more than anybody else, and I do a ton of research because I don't like I'm not saying that I'm not immune to propaganda. I'm totally get like I've totally been tricked by propaganda before, right? But what I do is I take the time to actually research these claims that are being made, actually understand the argument. Like, this is a really weird thing. Like, when I was a kid, they would, like, whenever I saw like a sale or something, I'd be like, why are they doing a sale? This doesn't make any sense. Like, what do they actually gain from this? And then I'd be like, oh, they do sales because they need to get rid of all the stuff that people aren't buying, and then they'll make it seem like it's a really good deal when actually it's not a good deal, and they're still exploiting people for their labor and etc. And I just clicked a button on my computer that has made a bunch of yellow things popped up. Okay, now they're gone. But like, you know what I'm saying is that these things take time. If you take everything at face value and try to come up with a good critique, and then it's not going to happen. Philosophers, right, back in the day, their responses would take months. They would be sitting there at their table thinking for ages of how to make their argument actually come back. And I know that in this like modern era where we want everything really quickly, we kind of forget that, good critiques and good criticisms take time. That's why sources written by Harvard and written by universities like Oxford, Cambridge, all these big universities where they go into in-depth research, have like tens of page, like loads and loads of pages where they have to deal with all the variables, where they have to explain all these things to actually come with a good critique. But we just want to take the conclusion of all these things and just, accept it as fact. And that's a problem. We have to understand that good critiques, good criticism take ages. That's why when I'm looking at philosophy, loads of people think philosophy is a waffle subject. It is not. In philosophy, you have to be very precise. But being precise doesn't mean short. Being precise means that you stick to the argument. And sometimes sticking to the argument is going to take a long time. I had to write like 2,000 words for Can We Gain Knowledge About the Real World? And I didn't really like waffle away for some points. Like, I was a little bit like logically structured, like it was a bit wrong and stuff, but like for me to actually deal with the whole argument, I had to go over a lot of things to actually come to a good conclusion that could be upheld. And that's not waffling. Waffling is when you stray on a random tangent that has nothing to do with what you're saying, but a good critique can be really long and not have any waffle because it stays on point. It just has to go into a lot of detail to explain it. Like, precision doesn't mean short. Precision can be really long. It just means that there's a lot of detail that you have to cover. So when people talk about like good criticisms, they usually are much longer because when you look at certain criticisms of something, the ones that are much longer and can deal with the argument at hand in much more detail usually come out with much better criticisms and much better conclusions and much better analysis because they took the time to go through all of the evidence provided and actually come to a substantive conclusion. Also, a big tip that you have to recognize, please don't fall for the middle ground. Oh my God, don't fall for the middle ground fallacy. Do not be Joe Rogan. My God, Joe Rogan does this. Joe Rogan will go from buddy buddy with far right extremists on his podcast to saying, yeah, Bernie Sanders, you have some really good policy positions. Like, wait a minute, why you don't have to play the nice guy in all these things. You don't put two things on the different side of a spectrum as equal. Like, this is the thing, it's like we equate far right extremism with far left extremism all the time, and that comes from decades of propaganda and fear mongering from the right wing through, you know, like the McCarthy era, etc. But really, if you look at, like, if you do what I did with the extrinsic and intrinsic elements, you look, what's intrinsic to right-wing politics? Hierarchies, dominant authority, small inequality, a small amount of people controlling a lot of power. And you look at these things and you think, okay, that's intrinsic to, like, right-wing politics. And you look at left-wing politics, what's intrinsic to left-wing politics? Equanimity, egalitarianism, democracy, liberty, fraternity, all these things are intrinsic to left-wing politics. So how can we treat something, I talked about this in the feminism, how can we equate feminism, which is all about the egalitarian model of, you know, putting people, upholding people, treating men and women of different the same despite them being from different genders, with Nazism, which is literally intrinsically based on hatred and exclusionary politics. You can't equate exclusionary politics to egalitarian politics, because that is just unfair. You can't say that, hey, this thing that opts to, you know, give medicine as a human right to all people is as radical as people who, you know, want an ethno state. Like, this is the thing that happens in American politics all the time. Bernie Sanders is regarded as a far left radical, a left winger. He's barely a social democrat. Like, he all he wants is free medicine for people. Boris Johnson wants that. Boris Johnson wants to uphold the NHS. He says he does anyway. So we can't really be equating far left with far right and just opting for this enlightened centrist, like, oh, look, the left and the right. Like, this is the thing that I succumbed to as, like, a teenager. Like, oh, the left and the right, they're both equally crazy. We should treat them both the same. No, Nazis and the right wing and this, you know, alt-right should be treated very differently to people on the left, because people on the left are not the same as Nazis. Okay, and we need to get over that. Hey guys, you've reached the end of this part of the podcast. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to carry on, please continue on to the end and it will autoplay on, or press on the next episode in YouTube or in Spotify. If you don't want to carry on, then go ahead and be ignorant about the rest of the world. That's your choice, not mine. Anyway, I'd like to thank you for listening and hope you have a great day.